Ruth Wilson Gilmore is professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She received an MA and MFA, Masters of Fine Arts, in Dramatic Literature and Criticism from Yale, and a PhD in Geography from Rutgers University. Gilmore is the author of Golden Gulag, Prisons, Surplus, Crisis, and Opposition in Globalizing California, published in 2007. Her recent publications include Race, Prisons, and War, Scenes from the History of U.S. Violence, and Forgotten Places and the Seeds of Grassroots Planning. Gilmore is also a founding member of the anti-prison groups California Prison Moratorium Project and Critical Resistance, and a founding member and past president of the Central California Environmental Justice Network. She is the recipient of a long list of awards and is the president of the American Studies Association. We have reached Ruth Wilson Gilmore by phone in Toronto, where at the University of Toronto later on today, she will be giving a talk organized by the Center of the Study for the United States. This talk is titled Gender Responsive Prison Expansion or Notes on a Route and Hope for a Route. Hello, Ms. Gilmore, and thank you for being on the Prison Radio Show today.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here.
So I have to admit that I have not read your book, Golden Gulag, but I assume it's how California has led the way of prison expansion in America?
That's correct.
Okay. So I was wondering, why was it, though, that California was in the forefront of increased incarceration and prison building in the U.S.?
Well, California hit a crisis of enormous proportions back in the 1970s. There was deep disinvestment in industrial production. There were big changes in how agriculture was produced. There was a constant in-migration of people, both internationally and nationally. And there was a big fight over who should pay for public services, including the University of California, which was the envy of the world. So in the midst of all of this fighting, a couple of things happened. One, the big corporations and banks managed to get laws rewritten so that they could pay less and less of a share of state taxes. And that burden fell on someone. It fell on homeowners and real estate owners. Homeowners being the kind of classic case of people who have one and only one kind of wealth, which is their home equity, and who are usually wage or salary workers, not rich people. So the big real estate companies organized themselves and actually organized homeowners into fighting against this new burden that they had gotten because the big banks and corporations had gotten out of paying taxes. And they passed something that's notorious in the United States, Proposition 13, that capped property taxes. Good for the mom and pop and a windfall for the big landowners and real estate owners around the state. So in the midst of all this crisis, in the midst of massive job loss, inflation, and all of this fighting over who should pay taxes, it became apparent to a number of different kinds of public personas, people running for state office, people trying to keep from being voted out of state office, and others, that they could deflect the larger problem of which capitalists should pay and turn attention to who should be excluded from society. And so what they did was they took all of the kind of bureaucratic and fiscal capacity that they had in the state that they'd used to build schools and hospitals and highways and roads, and with a rising unemployed population, very, very, very much identifiable by race and ethnicity based on the different economic sectors that were collapsing, they managed to use prison expansion and then criminalization as a means to legitimate the state government and to make people think that what the big problem was crime, and therefore the solution would be punishment, rather than the big problem was the capitalists were taking all the money and the solution would be tax the capitalists.
Wow. that is really putting it in a nutshell. Thanks. And very well explained. Today you're going to be doing a talk, and it's called Gender Responsive Prison Expansion, or Notes on a Route and Hope for a Route. It is my understanding that you will be critiquing gender responsive incarceration policies. Is that so?
I will, and I'm going to use very specifically the case of California.
Could you first maybe explain to our listeners what are gender-responsive incarceration policies?
Certainly. As listeners may know, and I assume I'm speaking to people inside as well as outside, prisons are, in the United States, and I think in most places around the, many places around the world, are designed according to what we call a military model. The designers imagine, and the managers enact the imagination, that the average prisoner is an 18-year-old healthy male. That's more or less the kind of person who goes into the armed services, even though more and more women go in. So they design the entire prison system, the buildings, the services, everything, as though what prisoners were on the average healthy 18-year-old males. They're not. So a lot of people advocating for people in prison have pointed out the differences, for example, between men and women, between gender variant prisoners in prisons for men and prisons for women, between old prisoners and middle-aged prisoners, between youth and older prisoners. So I'll be focusing today on how some of the arguments around gender responsive prisons, which is to say how the arguments advocates for people in prisons for women made to try to save the lives of women in prison turned into a policy that emerged as a plan to build more prisons.
So stating that, like, how are you going to be able to put like the feminist and abolitionist concerns in regards to this whole topic?
Well, it's actually easier done than said, if I may turn around the usual phrase. And that is to say, there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands, probably pretty close to 2 million of the 2.5 million people who are in prison in the United States today, who are there for reasons that could be addressed through other means. They are serving longer and longer sentences for things that either didn't used to be crimes or just have longer sentences attached to them. And one of the problems many people face, whether they're in prisons for men or prisons for women, is that when they come out back to the community, there's nothing there waiting for them for reasons that are pretty well known in the States. And therefore, people very often have no way to get through life than to get into a path that sends them back to prison, including, most especially in California, people who have their parole violated on a technicality rather than people who go out and commit new crimes. So the abolitionist perspective is, well, if there are all these people who are going to come out of prison anyway and whose problems can be addressed differently, whether they're problems of illness or income, violence or not, should not be in prison, and that we ought to figure out and use the resources that are available to build new prisons to do something else in the communities where prisoners come from.
But we're living in a world right now where, unfortunately, the vast majority of people don't think along those lines. How do we kind of like push that forward, this agenda, that this or that this perspective, this abolitionist, penal abolitionist perspective?
Well, lots of different ways. I mean, some people use stories, the kind of human interest story. So, for example, in the past year, the CNN, the television, the global television statement, had a competition for Hero of the Year. And one of the people who was nominated, she made it into the finalists but didn't win the big prize, the woman named Susan Burton. Susan Burton is a native of California who for many years was doing what we call life on the installment plan, going to prison, coming out, going back, coming out. And about 20 years ago, she came out and managed to stay out. And she decided to think critically and imaginatively about what was different than the last time out, and then to figure out if she could reproduce those conditions for people like herself, women coming out of prison, in her case, women with families on the outside who she wanted to be reunited with. And so they were very, very basic things, shelter, drug counseling, job training, getting your ID so that you can do basic things. Really, really simple, straightforward things. So she, a person with many felony convictions, did the work of organizing shelter for women coming out of prison, and then eventually convinced prison wardens to send women coming out of prison to her, even though she had once been under their control. And so women came out and came out and came out, and now hundreds of women have gone through this program. They have very high success rate. They don't go back to prison, and it's not something that's controlled by the Department of Corrections. It's controlled in the community by the women who live in the houses. So that's one way, is just to get have people know what happens in the world. There are many other ways as well. There are ways in which we can see that the warehousing of modestly educated women and men in the prime of their life takes away resources from all kinds of other things that could be enhanced and improved were such people able to be in their communities and those resources used for all kinds of people, not only the people who have been in prison. So there's a lot of work that goes on in many places, including California, to do what we call anti-racist budget work, budget advocacy. And indeed, in New York State, the new governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, has proposed closing some prisons upstate, making some resources available to the communities where the prisons were so that they're not economically devastated, although I have a lot to say about that, and then putting resources into the communities where prisoners come from so that people who are out can stay out and people who come out can stay out. The entire state of Connecticut has also embraced such a route. So part of it is just making possible for people like those who are listening today to find out these things are being done.
And also there's public education, and I would imagine like this documentary Visions of Abolition from Critical Resistance to a New Way of Life. And you're one of the, I guess you could call, talking heads in this documentary.
I'm definitely a talking head. Yes. My head.
so maybe you could share with us maybe a minute or two, like what is about this? Why should people kind of like check out this this video? Because you're selling it for reasonably inexpensive online.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So a group of students, actually, at the University of California, Riverside, a public school that has, over the years, developed a student body that is all working class, very large proportion students of color, almost all first generation, whether they're white, brown, black, Asian American, new immigrants, or longstanding residents. And the students in a media class wanted to understand what abolition is. They were confused. They could understand abolition in terms of ending slavery in the 19th century, but they couldn't imagine what it had to do with the 21st century. So their professor, Setsu Shigematsu, said, well, let's make a movie. Let's explore this. Let's figure out what it is. And so what the movie does is it talks to a lot of people, yes, talking heads, but our expertise is various. Susan Burton, who I mentioned earlier, is in the film, Angela Davis, me, and other people. And we talk about all of the ways in which our ability to have opportunities for advancement and protections from calamity are constrained by the way that our society turns to punishment as all-purpose solutions for social, economic, political, and cultural problems. And so the video, which is in two segments, so you can watch some and rest and watch some, explains in great detail and very totally accessible detail what it is the vision of abolition is about.
So we only have about a minute or so left, but I got a question. I wanted you may possibly to share. What has been the biggest successes that you have found out of your anti-prison organizing?
The biggest success that we found out of our anti-prison organizing has been our ability to persuade all kinds of people who are organized in other ways to understand that prison abolition is part of their agenda, too. So, for example, public sector employees can see this. Even employees who work in prisons can see how shifting resources back to education and services and so forth by decarcerating people and providing services in communities is good for everybody. So that's probably the biggest success we've had.
Well, thank you very much, Ruth. You've been listening to the voice of Ruth Wilson Gilmore, professor of the City of City University of New York Graduate Center. Ms. Gilmore spoke to us about moving beyond incarceration and other ways of how to deal, I guess, dealing with our harms in our communities through abolition. Ruth, thank you so much for being on the Prison Radio Show today.
My pleasure. Goodbye.
Goodbye. If you're interested in checking out the documentary where Ms. Gilmore is one of the people featured, go to www.visionsofabolition.org.